From WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. We start this week with some recent science headlines brought to us by our friends at the journal Nature. I'm joined now by podcast and video editor Benjamin Thompson. Good to talk with you again.
Great to speak to you, too. Thanks for having me on.
Let's start with this story about butterfly genomes. The headline, every butterfly in the United States and Canada now has a genome sequence. What does that even mean?
I mean, yes, my goodness, what an undertaking this is. This is a team of researchers based in the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center, and they have, sequenced the genomes of 845 butterfly species, as you say, in the United States and in Canada.
Wow. I mean, but these are not the glossy full color versions like when we say we've sequenced the human genome and it's all been put together in order and is very neat and clean. This is kind of more of a rough draft of these genome sequences. What are they actually able to do with them? What are they trying to do with them?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think there is a mix. There are some of these high-quality sequences, but many of them are low-quality in inverted commas. They're called draft sequences, which are made up of sort of thousands of short DNA stretches, you know, sort of put together. But what's useful about this is that these researchers are able to try and put together a bit of a map to answer some of the really big questions in evolution, which is, you know, why some of the branches of the tree of life are so diverse and others aren't.
Hmm. And is there a reason to do this with butterflies and butterflies in North America for the first effort at doing this kind of work? Or is it just so happened that's the species they chose or the researchers who chose to do this?
Well, that is a very good question. I mean, I think what this sort of started in 2012 when the researchers saw a paper about one particular sort of butterfly that was able to mimic other butterflies. And so they wanted to look at the genes that were sort of underlying that. So I think that's where the sort of essence of this story started. But what's interesting about this one is where they've got these butterflies from. And it's quite a nice kind of tie-up between a lot of sort of museums and natural history sort of museums and what have you. And actually these researchers themselves who, rather than flying to conferences, sort of took road trips and took nets out and caught some live butterflies as well.
Hmm, pretty fun. And what have they found from doing all of this work?
Yeah, I mean, I think what they've managed to do is sort of put together this a little bit more of detail into this kind of a evolutionary web of life, and they've kind of been able to determine the pace at which sort of some new species have formed. And their work suggests that these fast diversifying groups of butterflies sort of swap genes with close relatives through interbreeding. And this is what's speeding up the kind of evolution of new species.
Okay, Benjamin Thompson, from mapping the tree of life on Earth to perhaps searching for life elsewhere in the solar system, for the first time, we now have a global map of Saturn's largest moon, Titan, which has been of interest, maybe one of the best candidates for life on Earth. So what does that global map look like now?
Yeah, so I think we're not able to answer today whether or not life has been found on another planet in the solar system, but I think this is a super interesting thing. So Saturn's largest moon, and Saturn is the planet, of course, outside of Jupiter in the solar system, so a very, very long way away. And the Cassini spacecraft was orbiting Saturn from 2004 to 2017, and it collected a vast amount of information about Saturn and about its moon, so in Titan in particular, of which 100 flybys were done, and so it sort of peered in through this thick atmosphere and really surveyed the terrain of this moon in unprecedented detail.
It's pretty cool when you think about the centuries that went into mapping our own planet. First, you know, people just walking around and creating very local maps, up to what we now have with satellite imagery. To think that this is kind of our first pass at a map of Titan, and it is this amazing global picture of the whole planet, and apparently some surprises in terms of what they're finding there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to throw some numbers at you here. I mean, so two-thirds of Titan's surface was consisted of flat plains, 17% covered in sandy dunes, 14% classified as hummocky, which is this wonderful word meaning hilly or mountainous, and 1.5% were described as a sort of a labyrinth-style terrain, so valleys carved by, you know, rain and erosion. Very few impact craters, apparently, which the researchers suggest meaning that this moon surface is quite young. But what is interesting to me, certainly, and I think to researchers as well, is that Titan is the only world in the solar system, aside from Earth, with bodies of liquid on its surface. Now, these aren't liquid water in the case of Titan. This is liquid methane, or methane, you might call it, where you are. And they cover, well, just 1.5% of the moon's surface.
And is that potentially a target for looking for life on Titan? I mean, and now that we've got this whole map, presumably part of the effort is to figure out where they might go to look for life?
I think NASA is sending a drone to Titan, the Dragonfly mission, in 2034. So we'll have to get me back on to, you know, sort of let you know what they find then. And this will sort of be flying across the surface and studying it in multiple locations. I mean, you're right. Landing on planets to look for stuff is sort of what needs to be done. But I think it will be a ways away then. So there's no other plans after this Dragonfly mission to actually land anything on Titan, as I'm aware of.
All right, Benjamin, switching gears a little bit again, but sticking with space and satellites, SpaceX recently launched 60 communication satellites, which, I mean, in some ways seems like a big number given how many satellites are already orbiting the Earth. Maybe not that big a number, especially given that it kicked up a bit of a furor that the astronomers are really worried about the impact that communication satellites might have on their ability to observe the rest of the solar system. What's the concern there?
So these satellites form what's known as mega constellations, and their aim actually is to try and provide global internet access, which, you know, certainly for places with limited resources. So that, you know, a big aim there. But you're right, there is some concern among astronomers that these satellites, and I think there's only a few up at the moment, I think plans are potentially to launch thousands and thousands of these by a variety of different companies, they could interfere with measurements and with observations and what have you. In some cases, the concerns are because these satellites, they might be quite brightly coloured and they sort of might streak across the sky. So if you've got a very long-running kind of exposure from a ground-based telescope, you know, that could kind of mess things up a little bit. And there's also maybe concern that if these satellites are beaming radio waves back to Earth, you know, for communication or what have you, that might interfere with different sorts of telescopes, sort of radio telescopes that are looking at these radio waves, and maybe render some of their findings maybe null and void.
Yeah, double-edged sword there, perhaps enhancing our understanding of our own planet and our own ability to communicate, but making it a lot harder to get outside the bubble, as it were.
What's going on? I mean, what I will say going on at the moment, discussions are ongoing about how to try and mitigate this. I mean, some of them involve maybe potentially painting the Earth-facing side of these satellites black so they don't necessarily show up as much light in these kind of light streaks as people are worried about. And also discussions are ongoing about maybe limiting particular frequencies of radio or not using certain frequencies when experiments are going on, these sort of things. So a lot of discussions ongoing.
All right, last but not least, Benjamin, there is a great story in Nature about maybe a new approach to funding science, maybe not going to take over everything. But, you know, we've heard a lot in recent years about how much more competitive grants from governments have become, how much harder it is to get science funding. Apparently, some agencies are literally creating a lottery system. So what's the goal there?
Yes, quite the thing, this one. So for your listeners who might not be aware, so if scientists are applying for grant money from a funder, maybe a government or a, you know, philanthropic organization, there'll be a big pot of money and they will send in a grant application. And these are usually, you know, fairly sizable documents. And then a panel will assess these and rate them. And maybe the top few percent will get funded. And then it's in the middle percent is a bit more difficult to work out who gets the money. Right. So I think there's been a few calls from, you know, a few organizations to try and sidestep that by literally using chance in some instances, or at least partially using chance to try and avoid that kind of that difficult middle where it's hard to know if something's the 20th best or the 21st best. So if everything passes a kind of a minimum hurdle to at least be considered, all these sort of grant proposals go in a hat, and I think maybe literally a hat, we were told in some cases, and get drawn out, and those that get drawn out get the money until the money's spent.
It also seems like perhaps embracing, you know, some of the serendipity that it's never entirely clear which research will end up becoming the next really important invention. And this is just kind of maybe a nod to that, hey, we can't always know what science is going to be the most important in the long run.
Well, and it's got other potential benefits as well. I mean, I think from what we understand is it may help alleviate unconscious biases and what have you like that. So if you don't know anything about these people and what they put in, you kind of hopefully would try and mitigate anything like that arising.
All right. We'll keep an eye on that for sure. Benjamin Thompson is part of the podcast and video team at the journal Nature. Thanks so much for keeping us up to date.
Not at all. My pleasure.
Up next, whether and how to broach difficult topics at the Thanksgiving table. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break.